Hello and welcome to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter, and today I'm speaking to no less than three fund managers. Today we have Peter Michaelis, Simon Clements, and Chris Foster. All three managers work on Liontrust's Sustainable Future team, responsible for a handful of very strong performing ESG equity funds. These three would work as the lead managers on the Liontrust ESG Trust. That's an investment trust that's due to do an IPO in the coming weeks. I'll be speaking to the team about how the trust will differ from their existing funds, what criteria they look for when buying companies, how ESG is changing, and why they hold the likes of Alphabet. Simon, Peter, and Chris, thank you for joining me today. It's been interesting that you guys are now focusing on plans for an investment trust using your established investment process. I suppose it begs the question, why now for an investment trust?
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, so we on the sustainable investment team at Liontrust, we're sort of not in the habit of launching products very frequently. The last time we launched a new strategy was 2014, and so we put a lot of thought into the investment trust and what we could do to make it distinctive from the open-ended funds that we run. Now, the open-ended funds have been running since 2001, so it's a 20-year track record. Where we've set out to deliver strong returns by investing in sustainable companies. And that's going to be the foundation for the investment trust. But in addition, there will be some distinctive features which the closed-end nature of the investment trust lends itself to. So the first is that in comparison to the open-ended fund, there will be a wider opportunity set of companies. So we'll look across the globe for sustainable businesses that make great investments, but we will be looking down the market cap scale, so down to the sort of even 100 million market cap, whereas our open-ended fund has a 2 billion cutoff. Secondly, we're looking to have a more concentrated strategy, so it'll be about 30 stocks within the portfolio rather than the 50 which you find in our open-ended funds, and those will be concentrated in companies exhibiting superior sustainability characteristics in terms of their products and services. So on a matrix, it'll be only the A's and B's, whereas the open-ended can invest in the C's as well. So those are two very distinctive aspects. In addition, our clients in the open-ended funds care about how their money is invested, the nature of the businesses that they're invested in. And so for the investment trust, we will be, reporting on the positive nature of the business's activities. So through the themes that they're linked to, and we'll talk more about that, but also the sustainable development goals. And then another feature is that we will be using a portion of the management fee to fund research and development into sustainable development goals, which are hard to invest in currently. So it's, if you like, it's thinking long term about creating more investment vehicles to address important sustainability goals. And then the final element is that as an investment trust, we're able to use a moderate amount of gearing, which can potentially enhance returns. So those are the four distinctive aspects about ESGT, which we feel makes this a really interesting product that plays into the investment trust space and offers people who like investment trusts the opportunity to invest in our sustainable future strategy.
How does the greater concentration, say, compared with the open-ended Sustainable Future Global Growth Fund? How does that and the focus on, for example, small cap names affect the kind of risk levels and the potential returns?
We obviously run these through the risk models, and the difference in the main metrics we use is ex ante expected volatility of the fund, and it's about a percentage point above that of global growth. That's before gearing. With the gearing, it'd be marginally higher. But that really compares. So if you think about global growth is about 1% in terms of ex-ante volatility above managed growth, which is the next one down the risk category. So it's kind of just slightly above. So, you know, it's got less stocks. It's got, you know, it's not just got the small caps. It's a blend of some really interesting small caps with the really stable, high conviction, large cap names. And obviously it benefits from the diversification of the process. So the overall volatility is, it's a little bit higher, but it's kind of commensurate with, you know, what we'd expect. You know, and it should, you know, it should perform reasonably similarly, but obviously, you know, each stock has a bigger position. And, you know, you'd expect a more concentrated fund to deliver more outperformance, you know, assuming the process is working well, which we fully expect it to.
Are you taking the or planning to take the more concentrated approach simply because you don't have the, I suppose, the drawbacks of an open-ended structure kind of preventing you from doing that? Or
yeah, exactly. You know, an investment trust is a closed-end vehicle. You don't have to deal with flows. You know, that you could, it's kind of the capital's there. So it allows you to kind of, you know, go more down that market cap end of the scale without having to, you know, trade some of these names, which can be more difficult to trade. And you kind of know, you know, you roughly know how big your fund is. So you know, it's much more kind of aligned with, you know, companies that have less liquidity. And also that kind of, I mean, our process is about long-term thinking. So it does align well with that as well.
Yes, I was interested to see in the documents about the trust, you mentioned the term time arbitrage. It's quite an interesting phrase about the idea of simply being kind of more patient than some other investors, perhaps. But going back to sort of moving further down the market cap scale, it's interesting you've mentioned small caps, and you've also mentioned unlisted companies, which is a kind of growing focus for many investment trust equity managers. What kind of records do you guys have in this space? Is it something you've dealt with before?
We don't have a record in unlisted, and that's why we won't be investing in unlisted. But the benefits of small cap, actually, Chris, do you want to talk to that, because you did a bit of work around, you know, what the benefits are around going smaller cap and also concentrating on those more sustainable companies.
Yeah, sure. So the first thing is really, you know, through our process, we didn't want to be constrained by the ideas that we found through our thematic idea generation process, which is all about finding big long-term sustainability trends and finding which companies are most likely to benefit from being exposed to those trends. And we thought the investment trust would allow us to be unconstrained in the size of the companies that we were able to invest in off the back of that investment process. And we think there's a number of reasons why over the long term, you know, smaller businesses, smaller cap companies tend to deliver some very attractive returns. We think there's less efficiency in those markets. We think they're less well covered, and there's less of an incentive structure behind analysts and sell side analysts covering these types of names, because they're much less liquid. They're unfortunately not able to be accessed by lots of fund managers. So we actually think the ability to kind of outperform and to find some really fantastic names that are less well covered is something that is really exciting. And as we touched on, you know, that the permanence of capital that an investment trust provides you with enables you to do that in quite a high conviction way, if that's what you would like to do. And on that basis, the reason we think that is an attractive thing to do is we've looked back at our own internal data, and we've realized that actually, from the companies we have previously rated on a sustainability basis, the stronger sustainability companies have actually gone on to outperform more significantly than the kind of the weaker sustainability rated companies. So the idea is to then therefore use this product to invest in the stronger sustainability names, the ones that are strongest in terms of their exposure to these really exciting long-term themes and trends that we're seeing in the sustainability landscape, but also the businesses that are the best managed and the best position to kind of take advantage of that exposure to those trends.
How does it work out in the kind of small cap space in terms of due diligence? You've mentioned there's kind of less coverage, and I imagine for any investor, there's kind of greater research to be done. But then you add the kind of ESG lens there. I mean, is that a bigger challenge than with some of the kind of larger companies?
So it's interesting, actually, that you should mention that, because on the face of it, the smaller businesses tend to have much smaller budgets. So they don't tend to have very detailed corporate social responsibility reports to kind of sift through, and they don't have huge teams working on the marketing behind that. Where the value is really add for us is actually meeting the company, often going to meet them physically when you're allowed to do such risky things like that, pre-COVID, and something we're looking forward to getting back to as soon as possible. But there's a real value to visiting these companies, finding out, understanding the culture, meeting people across the organization and understanding how they treat their employees, what it's like to work there. And there's a huge amount of value there, because one of our key beliefs in the team is that the integrating sustainability into an investment approach can deliver, we think, fantastic investment returns over the long term. And one of the reasons is it's very, very difficult to integrate really well, really key ESG metrics into financial modeling. And yet we think they really do drive performance. And that's a real key aspect. So kind of being able to go and visit these smaller companies and really get to know them, get to know the culture, get to know kind of how these businesses are run and managed, we think is actually a really useful insight and should help us find these businesses, and something we're excited about doing.
What are there any kind of key things you look for when you're trying to gauge, I suppose, whether a company is kind of walking the walk in terms of meeting those themes you're looking for, and generally kind of looking attractive from an ESG perspective?
Yeah, we've developed our own process over the last couple of decades, and we sort of split companies up into what they do, so the product and service, and we rank that in terms of sustainability, and that's sort of pretty clear. And the idea is, you think that our economy is developed to become cleaner, healthier and safer, so which areas of the economy are going to see an increase in growth in demand for their products. And so we rank companies from A to E on that basis. And that also links to our themes, the 21 themes, which are highlighting areas of the economy where there's that positive, predictable growth. In addition, we then analyze companies in terms of how they're managed. So how do they manage their key environmental, social, and governance exposures? And so that's looking at how they manage their employees, their incentives, their governance, environmental impacts, suppliers, customers, broader society. And those will be material to a varying degree depending on what sector you're in. But so that's the approach that we take, and we think we're over the years we've learned how to sort the sort of material factors from those that are sort of more, if you like, anecdotal or marketing based.
What's a good example of one sector, I suppose, where one kind of factor is more material than another? Are there kind of really dominant criteria you look for in one sector over another?
I'll start with this, but if you look at financials, so culture and governance and so things like net promoter scores of the customers are incredibly important, whereas, carbon emissions from their offices is less important. But then if you look at an industrial company, it'll be health and safety at work, energy use, relationship with suppliers. Those will be to the fore rather than others. I don't know, Simon, do you want to add?
I was gonna say the same thing. It's just a set experience, which is really important. And, net promoter scores is something we place a lot of value on, I think, across most of our businesses. Companies with really high net promoter scores who put their customers first is something that we value very, very highly. But also, it's about getting a feel for the culture of the business. And, that's a question that we always ask is, describe the culture. You know, a lot of people just talk about numbers. We'll try to talk about cultures. What's it like to work there? You know, what trying to find companies that are aligned with the sort of values that, that we feel are important for long-term success.
That's interesting. It's quite an interesting thing for investors to consider, I suppose, the way the criteria change depending on what kind of company you're looking at. More generally, on the ESG space, we've perhaps, some people would argue, ESG has finally hit something of a tipping point in the last year or so. If you look at kind of fund flows and indicators of investor interest, as you've mentioned, you've been doing this for a very long time now. How does that flood of money affect what you do? For example, I mentioned the kind of risk of greenwashing, and also I suppose it has a knock-on effect on valuations, which is interesting. I mean, does that kind of add any element to your things you need to look out for in your kind of due diligence process?
It's a really kind of pertinent question, and it's something that we, you know, we get asked about a lot, and we think about a lot. But I mean, we have a process, and you know, on the kind of valuation piece, you know, a key part of our process is valuation, fundamentals and valuation. And we've always, you know, for a period there was you know, things like, you know, Chinese solar is an example whereby Chinese solar was great from a sustainability point of view, but they were terrible investments, right? The business fundamentals were pretty much zero. So, you know, that part of the process protected us through, you know, not underperforming through, you know, in that area. So at the moment, you know, our valuation criteria is really important. Now with our valuation criteria, you look out 5 years and we work out what we think the business is going to deliver and what that's worth. So key flags that we look for is companies, you know, that may be, you know, part of some sort of emerging bubble, is whereby stock performance purely is driven by a re-rating of the multiple of the company, not commensurate with what we think the business is going to deliver. And often that's that the earnings don't really change, but the multiple changes a lot. Now, the multiple can change with the earnings staying the same for a variety of different reasons that can be justified. But it is, when you've been doing this for so long, you know, that you do have flags around valuation, and we won't touch any of those. Okay. So that's the piece around valuation. I mean, in terms of when you think about, you know, the kind of acceptance of ESG investing and the importance of it, particularly with flows, you know, you can't really argue against that. If you look at kind of net flows versus base, you know, investment, you know, percentage of investment, you know, you're talking multiples, so it is growing. And, you know, that means that's good and bad. It's good because the pie is getting bigger, but it's also, you know, there's more competition. So, you know, we really focus on what we do well. We've clearly got a lot more experience than you know, other people, but it's really important that, you know, we stay on top of the kind of the key trends that we you know, focus on, you know, what we're really good at. And I think that we've got a process and a team that's been together a long time that's proven the test of time. But, you know, it's clearly a very competitive space, and you know, we need to kind of, you know, stay on top of what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with your valuation discipline. Does that make it kind of quite painful sometimes to have to let go of companies that are actually really attractive in terms of, you know, what they're fundamentally doing, but they've just simply re-rated so much that it doesn't fit in with the process?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think often selling a stock that you really like, that's done really well for you, you know, that sadly doesn't fit the Valkyrie, it's always difficult. It's, you know, arguably, you know, one of the most difficult aspects of investing. But, you know, you really kind of have to do it. And the good thing about, you know, particularly this fund, and generally, you know, the global equities funds, which are pretty focused, is that, you know, we've only got 50 stocks. We've got thousands to choose from. You know, we shouldn't be, you know, there's always something, you know, more, there's something there that will fit all four parts of our criteria that we generally have waiting to go. And we don't turn over the fund a lot. So we only add a kind of handful of ideas a year. So, you know, we take the opportunity to do that. I mean, sometimes, you know, we've had stocks, we've done that, and we still watch them because we think, you know, that the company's great, but, you know, the valuation just is kind of just out of whack. So, and, you know, essentially we believe that valuation, you know, probably will normalize, you know, the company probably deliver, but, you know, the multiples probably maybe gone too high. So yeah, it's a challenge, but as part of the process and the discipline of what we do.
Did you find yourself last year being forced to kind of do perhaps greater levels of profit taking or anything like that, given some of the performance?
don't know if you want to talk through Trupanion, Chris. I think it's a great example of how we, you know, company that we love and how we kind of in practice have implemented the process.
Yeah, sure. So we stumbled across a company called Trupanion, which was a North American based pet insurance company, which is about as niche as it sounds. And what we particularly liked about this business was it was operating in a space whereby less than 2% of the 180 million pets across North America were currently insured. And that compares to, you know, Europe and the UK at kind of 20-25% of the population. We did a lot of work about kind of why that's the case. And our conclusion was really that the insurance products that were being offered just weren't typically very good. And this is where Trupanion came in. So Trupanion is a founder-led organization, and they basically tackled each of the issues around the insurance market and kind of designed a product that was meant to pay out a certain figure. So 70% of every dollar that came in as a premium was then designed to be paid out in terms of claims. So it was kind of flipping the insurance model on its head to make sure that the customer is being awarded a certain amount of value for their premiums, instead of the traditional model of insurance, which is try and hold on to as much profit as possible and pay out as little as possible. So it's a completely different business model. We really like this business. And we kind of invested in it first about 18 months ago. And as you know, what can tend to happen in markets is the shares didn't really do anything for quite a long time. And you know, we sort of acquired the shares at around $30 a share, and the business was continuing to deliver and grow the business really, really nicely. And everything was going really well. And then all of a sudden in 2020, the shares went from kind of $30 to $60 overnight. And then actually beginning of 2021, they hit $126 was the peak. And kind of going back to what Simon was saying, really that fourth aspect, when it came to refreshing what we thought the business was worth 5 years out, at $126 a share, unfortunately, despite the fantastic progress the business has made throughout that year, we just couldn't get the upside in order to merit holding on to that position. And I think one of the benefits of having concentrated portfolios is there's a huge competition for capital. So by staying in a name, you are making a decision that you're not investing in another company. And the great thing is about having, you know, a really well-resourced team is that there's always fantastic names coming through in the pipeline. So it's a nice place to be in. It kind of encourages competition for capital. But that's an example of a company that, you know, has exited the portfolio at the start of 2021. And yet it's a business that we think is fantastic and will continue to deliver, I'm sure.
Interesting. And within your themes, or perhaps within sectors, are there kind of any areas that either do look notably highly valued, and equally, are there any areas that you think actually have perhaps been a bit underappreciated and therefore look more interesting?
Market valuations are, you know, overall reasonably high at the moment. I mean, you can look at any metric. I mean, I think the question is, we're at just the start of another economic cycle, and I think generally things look really expensive then because the earnings are at the bottom of a cycle. I mean, I think that at the end of last year, you know, we did see some, you know, some full valuations in some of the growth technology names, and we had taken some profits there and recycled into areas of the market where we, particularly anything that, around our financial services, financial resilience themes, we saw some good opportunities. So, I mean, I think that that's probably reversed somewhat earlier in the year. I mean, I think we'll be honest and say that, I mean, it's hard to find, unless, you know, you're touching kind of, you know, really kind of more lower quality areas of the market. It's hard to find areas of the market that optically are very, very cheap at the moment. But, you know, obviously what that misses is that potentially the earnings that you're valuing that on are potentially, you know, at the very early part of a cycle. So, you know, if you focus on 5 years out, then, you know, we do find lots of opportunities for things which trade, you know, at valuations we feel are attractive.
Yeah. Speaking about another, I suppose, element of the ESG world, there's been, I suppose, a lot of interesting debate now about whether investors should focus on companies that don't necessarily look very good on an ESG criteria basis, in the hope that by kind of investing with them, by engaging with them, you can actually push through a lot of progress there. Now, that doesn't necessarily seem to perhaps fit with your approach, but is that something you have any kind of take on?
No, I mean, that's not our approach. I mean, it's a sort of valid a valid strategy to, you know, in a way engage in a sort of focused way to try and improve the ESG characteristics of a company, but that's not what we do. We focus on those companies that are already, you know, doing well in terms of sustainability. We will engage with them to get them to improve where we feel they need to improve, because no business is perfect. And that's how we play and utilize the useful information that's contained within the sustainability analysis. What I would say though about changing businesses is that I think it's easier to change how businesses are managed. So you can change that in, you know, in a few years. You can change the way a business is run. I think it's really difficult to change the entire nature of a business. So, you know, moving from being a sort of a fossil fuel based company to being a good clean energy company, you know, and then the sort of parallel that we have in our mind is, you know, things like Kodak and digital camera, or you know, Nokia and the smartphone. You've got to kill your business to grow into the next business, and that for so many reasons of culture, capital allocation, habit is just really, really, really hard to do. So that's not something we sort of put our resource into. What we try to do is focus on the best sustainable investments that we can put in the portfolio, because that's how we've delivered returns over time, and that's how we'll continue to do it.
Yeah. Do you think over time you might be able to have more of a focus on things like emerging markets if you start to see more progress there, or have you actually found yourself sort of considering companies there more?
I mean, we have invested in emerging market listed companies. We've invested in companies listed, or Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong. So Brazilian companies usually listed in the US. So it's, you know, it has something. I mean, we tend because our criteria is so kind of, we're quite stringent around disclosure and governance. It's really important to us.
Yeah.
You know, we don't understand how we can really kind of get to grips properly with the management of a company if it doesn't disclose anything. So that's often a barrier. Now, you're right, that's improving. But I think it's, you know, generally it's a reasonably kind of long way away from, you know, what we expect, because we are really going for the best quality companies now. But that doesn't mean, but remember, we do have a lot of emerging market exposure in our portfolio because of the globalized nature of companies these days. So you can get exposure to China, for instance, through, you know, a lot of the Japanese listed names, for instance, have very big operations in China and, you know, very, very high quality things like, you know, energy efficient air conditioners. And you can do that with a business that, you know, really you have a large amount of kind of you know, confidence in them. So, and remember, you know, it's 30 stocks in this portfolio, there's 50 in the core. You know, we really kind of choose to be picky. So we always say, we always look, we often, we rate companies, we don't completely ignore it. But as I say, to actually pass those four stages of the process, particularly that second one around sustainability analysis, it is, you know, it can be quite challenging in emerging markets just because disclosure is poor and the governance is often not what we're willing to kind of to accept in investment on behalf of our clients.
Yeah, I think even beyond ESG, particularly with areas like China, it's something that comes up again and again. You know, interesting source of growth perhaps, but people have understandable issues with things like disclosure. Moving back to another end of the markets. Your biggest holding, at least in recent disclosures, was Alphabet. So I thought, we've discussed this before, but I thought it'd be interesting just to touch on your approach to the FANGs. I approached you about this last year. You talked through Alphabet. You said Netflix was perhaps a closer one to maybe becoming investable, but weren't so keen on the others. Is that still kind of where you're at, or?
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is still not investable. It's not in the portfolio. You know, Alphabet is the one that's in the portfolio. I mean, we do, again, we do a huge amount of diligence, and, you know, our thesis on Alphabet, we are actually really comfortable with. You know, it is the one we you know, one of the ones we get asked about the most. Mm. You know, we do feel that the thesis around Alphabet is you know, kind of holds ground. We think it's strong enough. You know, there's obviously some negatives, there's also some huge positives, and we think, you know, on balance, it deserves to be available. It's obviously a big position too, because position sizes are built off not just the sustainability analysis, also the business fundamentals and the valuation. And, you know, Alphabet is very, very you know, appealing from both those last two particularly. So, you know, fundamentally, it's just a very, very good business. And, you know, again, you know, we feel that, you know, the core product is positive. We think that it's, you know, it's taking all that information from the internet and creating, you know, an accessible porthole, and it's something everybody uses every day. And there's obviously a lot of positives alongside things like the other bets, and they do this things in life science. There's things, you know, things like autonomous driving. They're, you know, the biggest player. And they really do use capital, you know, to try and attain, you know, in line with a lot of the kind of the goals that we have ourselves for where the world's going. So with some clear negatives as well, like, you know, the tax in the past, and, you know, obviously that there is some negativity around things like YouTube, but YouTube's only a small part of the business. So Chris is actually the analyst on the stock, so he might want to add some more. We do often get asked about it.
Basically, when you take the pros and the cons of the company, we think that there are clear net benefits to the company. So that's kind of our position on Alphabet.
Yeah. And what we try to do with our technology is to look at where technology addresses a particular vertical, a particular issue. And so we invest in Autodesk, which helps make the whole construction sector much more efficient. DocuSign, which is, you know, amazing in terms of reducing and speeding up the whole document processing, you know, part of the economy. Intuitive Surgical, you know, in terms of improving the productivity and efficacy of surgeons. Yeah, so it's technology for a very clear purpose, and we think that really underpins the investment case for those.
Yeah, you mentioned with Alphabet the perhaps some areas of controversy, and you've also held some other stocks that have kind of run into very controversial moments, like Kingspan, for example.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that when a company does kind of run into moments of scrutiny, bad press? I mean, what's your general process?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that we analyze companies. So we're looking for those companies which are going to be, you know, the better companies and the way they manage their environmental, social, and governance exposures. But no company is perfect, and nor do we have an infallible crystal ball. And so occasionally businesses will, end up with controversies surrounding them. And so the process that we undertake is firstly to, investigate, what is the actual issue? So to look at that in greater depth. It's then to ascertain that, the company's responsibility for that and what remedial action, they should take, and whether they can take that. And then it's a reassessment of our view, given this new information, in terms of the sustainability of that business. You know, our preference is always to try to work with businesses, because we think, we build a long relationship with businesses over the years, to work with them to say, look, this has happened, this has come to light, what are you intending to do with it? And this is what we would like to see. So that's the process. And ultimately it's a balance between engaging, or if we really think the issue has uncovered something we didn't know about that the company isn't going to adequately deal with, then we will sell the position. If you like, in terms of those sustainability, business fundamentals and valuation, if it affects the sustainability and the business fundamentals to a large degree, then we will exit the position.
Mm. Yes, it sounds like an interesting balancing act between the kind of longer term approach and trying to spot those genuine decisive issues.
I mean, obviously no one wants to wake up in the morning and see their company embroiled in a controversy, but the right thing to do is to use a sort of measured analytical process to go through to work out what is the best way to lead to a better outcome. Sometimes the easiest thing to do is to sort of sell the stock, but we don't think that's the right thing to do on behalf of our clients or the company as well.
Yeah. On to slightly different subjects. It's interesting how ESG processes can sometimes, I suppose, materially change how much of a market you can invest in. And that's always been an interesting element with the UK market. So it'd be interesting to talk briefly about your UK fund, kind of how much it excludes, but also I suppose there is a big sector in the FTSE 100 that you do have a big focus on that you've already mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, the UK market is interesting because the benchmark itself is dominated by lots of things that don't actually lend themselves to sustainability. So, very resource heavy sort of index, but tobacco is a big feature as well. Now, we don't actually look at the constituents, and we don't sort of start from the index and then work out what we can hold and what we can't. What we do is we say the benchmark gives you an indication of the returns that you're likely to see from this asset class, UK equities, and the volatility. And if we can deliver superior returns to our clients versus that, then we're doing a good job and it's worth the management fee that they pay us. I can't give you a sort of number as to what we exclude, but in a way we're trying to get to a 50 stock portfolio. So we're trying to exclude 90% of available companies in a way. And that's the filter, and sustainability is part of that.
As you mentioned, you're kind of big backers of financials, aren't you? Because it fits into your theme of saving for the future, increasing financial resilience. Is that the current format of the theme? I know you update them kind of now and then.
And ensuring a sustainable economy as well as the third one, the financial sector.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't, the fund, the global funds are marginally overweight financials. I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a huge part of the overweight, but we see the financial sector as, you think about the economy of the future, we think of a thriving financial sector is an important part of that, and there's certain things that they need to do. They need to try to provide products for saving, that do it in a kind of cost effective, and try to help with that knowledge gap. They also need to provide insurance, which gives safety nets to help help people improve the kind of safety in their lives, and also just banks that again look after their customers well, understand their customers well, and give a great service to them. And for us, that's really important. It's a really important part of a sustainable economy of the future, and that's really what we're about. We're trying to think about where we think the economy is heading.
I think financials has been a really interesting topical sector in the last year, because you've seen this rise of perhaps a new generation of DIY investors, at least in the kind of pandemics and lockdowns and that kind of thing. Has that had a big effect on your companies or how you think of the sector? Because you've had some really interesting events like the kind of GameStop saga. You've had the rush to cryptocurrencies, and on the one hand it's kind of interesting to see people more engaged with investing. On the other hand, there are perhaps valid concerns that people will kind of run into trouble and then never want to invest again.
Yeah, no, David, it's something that we're very aware of, because saving for the future, one type of business we really like is the investment platforms. So, you know, we hold Charles Schwab in the US to get exposure there. We've got a business called Avanza Bank in Sweden. And we also are investors in AJ Bell and Hargreaves Lansdown in the UK. And we think so initially, like Simon said, we basically think that people aren't saving enough today in order to fund the type of retirement lifestyles that they would like. And there's been a shift away from defined benefit pensions towards defined contribution pensions. Governments are increasingly indebted. And when you combine all of that, the onus is increasingly on the responsibility is increasingly on the individual. And therefore we think businesses that help individuals save more for their future are enormously important. So that's the kind of starting base. And we think that's one of the themes. You know, we think there's going to be a nice tailwind to these businesses. They also democratize investments as well, in the sense of, you know, they provide access to investment funds and products that they just wouldn't have been able to access previously without being quite wealthy and having a financial advisor to do all of that. So we really like the democratizing element as well. And they're also very low cost. You know, even Hargreaves gets a lot of headlines for being more expensive. But actually, when you think about, you know, less than 1% to manage to have access to these products every year, we think is actually quite an attractive proposition. And, you know, the customer service and the quality of the service they provide is fantastic. On the GameStop saga, and we were watching very, very closely, it is something that we are quite concerned about more generally, because you want people to be incentivized to be investing and saving for the future. And what you don't want is a big rush of retail investors piling into things that essentially may go down quite significantly in value. And therefore, you know, lots of people's savings go down a lot in value, and they lose faith and they lose kind of confidence in that mechanism for investing savings. So what we really like, and what we speak to these platforms about, is encouraging and educating their customers on something called dollar cost averaging, which I'm sure, you know, your listeners are very aware of. And we think it's a fantastic, fantastic thing to do. You know, it enables compounding, and compounding is literally, you know, one of the wonders of the world. The worst thing you can do is interrupt compounding. And that's something that we think is incumbent on the platforms that we invest in, to try and help educate their customers on kind of regular savings investments in, you know, quite diversified product. So it's something we're watching very, very closely. But we think, on the surface, we think it's great that people are increasingly engaged and interested in investing and looking after their own financial futures. We think that's on initially very positive, but we are closely following it.
Do you have similar concerns then on the kind of crypto side of things as well, or is that a different story?
Well, yeah, so we don't have very much exposure in the portfolio at all to what's going on in the crypto space. Mm. We're obviously watching it very closely, because it has potentially very large implications on a number of our portfolio holdings further down the line, in terms of how these cryptocurrencies develop, in terms of the blockchain technology, in terms of things like Ethereum and the opportunities that kind of may offer companies going forward. So we're closely following it, but we're not. There's nothing really exposed in the portfolio to those areas.
Yep, not a Bitcoin evangelist just yet.
Not yet.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.